This reading is from Richard Rose's Psychology of the Observer. Defining the self. For the purpose of consistency, I would like to begin by defining the self as the observer. We must separate the view from the viewer. The view is not the viewer unless we wish to speculate on the two merging somewhere in an absolute state of awareness. It is my belief that behaviorist psychologists fail to take note of this mental duality. Man's behavior is observable, but the behavior is not him. Man is not that which does, but that which observes the action. Yet man can be deluded, and one form of that delusion is conditioning, whether the conditioning be traditional or intentional. I prefer to define the self, the small s, as being the observable part of us, and the capital S self as being the observer. The latter is the real self. The former is our most immediate environment, the body with its reactions. Consequently, I will capitalize certain words, such as observe, to denote a special significance for that word. Let us start with the body. Earlier, I pointed out the absurdity of identifying the body as the only self. The body self diminishes, but the quality of the observing self does not diminish when the limb is amputated. The eyeballs themselves can be removed, but the observer still sees. The eyeball does not see. However, without the eyeball, the mind does not see either. Upon studying the process of sight, we come to the conclusion that seeing comes about only when the eyeball, connecting nerves, readjusting brain-mind, and still another factor, visualization, interact simultaneously. In other words, the senses inaccurately apprehend so that the recipient mind translates the incoming data from the inadequate senses and then projects a picture back upon the source of the percept to suit the purpose of adaptation. This projection is called visualization. This faculty of visualization is the lever by which the mind is able to direct the hand to reach for things accurately in an upside-down world. All seeing or incoming sensory data involves visualization. We live in a projected world. If lower form animals do not have the ability to perceive the same colors which we see, then they live in a different or incomplete projection. If certain animals possess superior or wider range as to hearing and smelling or homing instincts, then we live in a limited projection. The average person thinks that he sees or takes in the same image that he projects. However, we are all aware of the fact that we have optical hallucinations, which the eye of a neighbor does not see. What causes us to see the image in a hologram as being real? Remove the visualization process or affect it, and the person's world changes. In delirium, perceptions magnify and monsters may appear. Under hypnosis, a subject may be induced to treat a doll as a baby and a person as a sack of potatoes. Under hypnosis, some subjects become immune to pain and to the blistering effects of heat. Does this not indicate that the world of pain is a world of belief in pain? If the pain is projected and the blister is projected, then perhaps the feet of the firewalker and the finger of the hypnotized subjects are likewise projected. If you are interested in parallel readings along this line, you can read J.J. Vanderloo's book, The Conquest of Illusion. The word visualize means to create. My mind often goes back to the first pages of Genesis. I have always felt that there was a deeper allegory than that which appears literally. Paradise, in my interpretation, represents direct mind communication, perhaps among all creatures of all dimensions. Each human has the power to create and to project such visualizations. Visualization was the apple, which the pristine man should have avoided. He opened a new eye, one of his own doing, and closed forever the direct mind's eye. Not even God could find him, and God had to shout to find him. There are a few experiments which will demonstrate man's ability to project besides hypnosis. If we color a card black and leave the line white, which forms the outline of a face, and then stare at the image for a while, we will be able to see the image upon the wall when we take our eyes from the card. I am not attempting to establish or explain all the biochemical processes involved, but simply point out that man can project and seemingly witness objects where they do not exist. We can look at an apple, then close our eyes and still see the apple. We can go a step further and picture a string of yellow diamonds around the middle of the apple. We can visualize the apple as being made of marble with dark veins running through it, and then superimpose upon it the same string of diamonds. In this manner, we create a picture of a new type of apple, and in this manner, we may design a new type of body for an automobile, or we may invent an airplane by visualizing the aluminized wings of a bird supporting a cargo cabin. It is important to take note that we are talking about the process called thought, as we know it before having observed it analytically. We are victims of a mental process, visualization, which constantly fools us, and we often identify ourselves as being our thoughts. Visualization occurs with every perception at the time of perception. It must of necessity occur immediately with the arrival of the incoming percept, because the person often is required to act in harmony with and in response to the projection. We are inclined to think that visualization is something that occurs only in daydreaming. When we hear someone speak of a horse, we immediately picture a horse. We may see a black horse. If we do, does it remove our image of the horse to know that according to color analysis, the horse is colorless? But we cannot visualize anything as being colorless unless it is transparent. Not only do we visualize colors and sounds, but we also visualize personality, which we project upon living creatures. We come now to a new understanding of ourselves. If we admit that our body is not us, we realize that much of the visible world, including our body, may be erroneously projected or visualized. Are we then the sorting mechanism? Are we the creative force that converts transparent or colorless forms into beings possessing a personality and perhaps a soul? Or is the self now a more cognizant element within us which has the power to view our own inept creativity and erroneous projection ability, and which also is able to choose with impeccable intuition the beneficial creations and beneficial projections of our mental apparatus? We can now begin to answer these questions by pursuing the role of observer. This brings us to the admission that we can observe our own behavior, and we can observe not only our own thoughts, but we can also observe thought processes such as visualization and introspection. In discriminating between that which is the observer and that which is the observation, we simultaneously define the many observable mental characteristics as being not us. This means that the true self is always the interior observer, and the observation of the anterior observer brings us to the ultimate or absolute observer. This sounds first like a simple verbal manipulation or optimistic formula, but it is in reality the true method of reaching the realization of the absolute state of mind pointed to by writers on enlightenment. All knowledge falls into two categories, outside and inside knowledge. Outside knowledge is the world of the senses and is anything from celestial constellations to the amoeba in our bloodstream. Most of us wish to know that which is out there first. The external world attracts us from the moment of birth. And together with humanity, we build an orderly explanation of that which we, humanity, collectively see. Our external world is largely one of agreement, and the material science is really just a system of getting along. If we decide to check the checker before we get too far into the physical sciences, we may decide that we will never understand the external world properly until we know more about ourselves. And studying the inside of ourselves is a very simple process. We need not hold a doctorate in psychology to know about our thinking processes. All that is needed is some honest introspection. The findings that result can be stated in very simple terms. A good beginning would be mirror staring. We look at the mirror, and at first the image smiles back reassuringly. It implies that we are that which we thought we were. After a while, we will be able to pick up in the reflection certain moods and appetites. We may see the disastrous effects of some of our vanities written in our features as time goes on. And sooner or later, we will recognize that we are no longer the perfection that we once identified as being ourselves. We begin to realize that we are not a doer as much as a victim. We do not possess things as much as we are possessed by them. The facade of youth, with all its projection of nobility, begins to fade, and we have difficulty creating new forms of nobility to match the phases of decadence that never fail to surprise us as we march through our world of experience. In early youth, we identify with our thoughts and our desires as though they were possessions. People protest that they think and imagine that they are in control of the process, but man can neither stop thinking nor start thinking. He can rarely choose the subject material for his thought or the direction that his thoughts will take. He also thinks that his desires are an expression of his real self and often announces that he would rather be dead than be freed from his desires. However, if his desires are observable, then desires are objective and outside. When any subjective considerations are viewed, they immediately become knowable considerations and are then objective. By the use of the word objective, I do not infer that they are material, but I use it in the sense that any writer might in describing a comprehensive study of mental capacities. Freud would, in other words, consider his observations to be objective and to constitute a science he called psychoanalysis. Whether desires are recognized by us as gestalts or entities, they are external afflictions or assets. They are not us. It is not difficult to determine that they are not us. When we take the different desires into consideration, they do not work for the somatic self to any great advantage in some instances, let alone be faultless facets of our real self. We get our clearest pictures of the remoteness of the understanding of the true self by watching the interplay of desires. For instance, we have the hedonistic desires with their obsessing fetishes. We also have the desire for food, for youthful permanence, for immortality, for power, for security, and even for offensive action toward others. We also have an array of fears that result from some of these desires. If we become obese from the responses to our desire for food, then a fear may set in. The desire has become conflicting with the other desires for youthful permanence and for survival. Hedonistic practices may cause ill health, and once more we realize that these things cannot be us because they are about to kill us. Our conscious hours may become battlefields of these desires, and after a while, strange desires, hitherto unknown to us, may make their appearance. We may desire peace of mind or oblivion. When we first witness our desires, we begin to detach ourselves from some of them and deny that they are us. If we possess a particular sexual fetish that meets with public disapproval, we will begin to deny the affliction publicly while perhaps indulging the fetish privately. If we are caught, then we can blame it on the devil and lay claim to a desire for immortality. First, we witness the desires and their interaction, and then we notice that they are collectively form a process which an interior self is monitoring. Most of us are, to some degree, aware of our desires, but few of us are aware of the monitoring procedure. The early theopsychological authorities referred to this monitor as the conscience. I prefer to call it the umpire. The desires are all beneficial forces for the entity involved, but they can get out of hand. Our desires for immortality can result in inquisitions or holy wars against any unbelievers. Our desire for youthful permanence may lead us to fetal regression. Our desire for the sensuality that results from using drugs may impair our mentality. The little voice that tries to warn us of these trends is all that is left of the real self, which is still only a mundane self, and which is the umpire. The umpire might be called the somatic mind. The umpire and all of the desires and fears with which it deals are programmed into the body. The umpire is an observer planned for the robot to keep the robot from destroying itself before harvest time. The sensual drives in man, together with his craving for food, are primitive goads to keep him going and to maintain in him a belief that he is doing something of importance. The desire for immortality, which is really the fear of extinction, may form part of his rationale for reproduction. Man is programmed to have a strong desire for food and security, and these desires often conflict with the desire for endless sensuality, and if these former desires are not strong enough, the species will deteriorate and lose its health and perhaps become runted down from laziness and inbreeding. And when man becomes conscious of these things about his nature and seems to take steps individually and collectively in the form of moral codes, then his umpire has become vocal and functional. It might be a good idea to try at this point to define the umpire in greater detail. I do not think it is necessary to try to relate to all of the concepts that have been given out in regard to mental reaction and mental reasoning. I maintain that reason is nothing more than a reaction process which goes on in all of us and is monitored by a built-in observer. We all admit to reasoning, but few of us wish to take note that we're able to observe the process. In other words, we lay claim to being the reaction process instead of that which watches and perhaps decides. The umpire is chiefly a somatic mind, the bridge between the material external world and the anterior mind, meaning the observer of the umpire. It is the rational mind. In the animal, it decides which food to eat, when to rest, and when to flee. In the human, it makes those same decisions and perhaps many more. All actions involve three possible courses to take: the positive, the negative, and the neutral. We can take the right road, the left road, or remain at the forks. The word umpire was chosen because it is simple and descriptive. The word conscience has the connotation of superstition. Man's moral and spiritual promptings are umpire decisions stemming from man's desire to live forever. There is simultaneously within man a sense of essence, a deep feeling that he may be a soul instead of just a body, but the experts, the theologians, have given him no more than food for superstitious guessing. Man cannot see that soul with his body. With the body senses in modern psychology seems to indicate that our most scientific psychologists cannot see the mind even. Man sees the body as well as the physical world with his mind. However, despite the inaccurate sensory abilities, this is demonstrated in the comments about visualization. The mind is still not the essence. The mind is a cloudy dimension that serves as a bridge between physical projections of the mind and the essence itself. Since all that we see is projected by the mind to some degree, it is impossible to know how much about the material world except to know that it is not that which it seems and may be only a mental exudation and less solid or real than the mind. This projection world or exudation may not be anything permanent but may only be a flux of projections ebbing and waning to the force of whatever projectors are involved. Only the essence is real, but to us it is nebulous. It is we who are nebulous, struggling from one shadowy dimension to another. The theme is portrayed vividly in the Tibetan Book of the Dead. I do not attempt to prove the Tibetan Book of the Dead. You consider it to be a very intuitive writing or just science fiction. First, before adopting any books, this exercise should be tried, this process of pursuing the observer. We must first admit that if our rational mind can be deluded, then only the remaining point of hope for immortality may rest with our evidence of awareness, self-awareness. And the observer is that which is self-aware, and with this process, the observer can become capital S self-aware. Then, when that latter person reads books like the Tibetan Book of the Dead, he will marvel at the wisdom of a group of people who, thousands of years ago, may well have had the answer, as well as an accurate psychological system. The umpire is not perfect because it has inadequate senses to feed to it data about the body and the world. We can witness the workings of the umpire, and this apparency makes the umpire an observable manifestation. Our evaluation of the umpire is scientific because it functions pretty much the same in all people, and consequently, its functioning is predictable. Based upon this predictability, contemporary psychology presumes that it can expound a faultless science of psychology. There is a limit to the predictability of the umpire because the umpire gets some data from a mind dimension which is not immediate or related to the person under scrutiny. The individual mind is in close contact with the body, but it is also in contact with a mind dimension in which many individual minds participate. This is demonstrated by telepathy and ESP. To give an example of this umpire functioning, one of the reasons that the umpire is capable of making mistakes lies in the fact that it does not see accurately. The messages coming into it are limited to the color range of the eyes, the sound range of the ears, the taste range of the taste buds. The smell sense and the touch sense are likewise limited. Yet all children have the same reaction to the external world. The mind is not infallibly interpreting things because large groups of people may be fooled by a mirage, having seen the same thing and later realize that they have no explanation for that which they thought they saw. How many mirages are seen that are believed as being reality and are incorporated into that which is considered to be our material world? We can always say that adults have been conditioned. But a newly born child or a young animal is showing us a ready acceptance of and agreement with the illusory parts of our worldview demonstrates that if there was any conditioning of that child or animal, it occurred before the child was born. And more importantly, how many diaphanous creatures and objects occupy the same place which we do, forever unseen because of some simple difference like a variation in molecular speed or particle speed, the particles being the equivalent of electrons in size. A baby born untutored in the knowledge that his lenses read things upside down does not have to be told how to adjust. It does not have to be told how to cry. The crying is spontaneous and it is not learned. It occurs before the infant has time to experiment with its voice as it does with its hands. What is it that teaches a bird or insect to produce a unique noise needed to summon the mate for breeding? We can say that there is a program embedded in the DNA molecule, but what causes that individual umpire to allow and encourage a process which has meaning to the individual only after a particular note or series of notes has been produced? We can go a step further and take into account that the world is a partial illusion, at least in that we only partially experience it. Limited senses can determine a limited experience only. Yet, why do all of us see the same things? Even the animals manifest by their behavior that the world that they see is accepted by them, as it is accepted by us, as being real. We find no animals deviating from the belief plan of world acceptance, even though their eyes may not have the same color range, nor their ears have the same hearing range. Manifestly, all creatures whose bodies are constituted of similar molecular patterns witness the same type of substance. Some domestic animals seem to be able to see things which are invisible to us, but which are really enough to them so as to fill them with fear. Most of the owners of these animals do not have any doubt that the animal is seeing a spirit. Yet this ability to witness another dimension by such an animal does not change the animal's acceptance of this dimension as being real also, if such witnessing is real. It boils down to this: whatever the nature really is regarding the material world, all creatures are in agreement about it, and they are in touch with it as soon as they are born, if not before, even though that worldview is seriously altered by our imperfect sensory apparatus. The human mind seems less in touch with the minds of other people than it is with the universal projection. By universal projection, I mean the universal tacit agreement about the nature of our physical world and the unquestioning acceptance of destiny that involves a fear of injury and death, which is part of that destiny. We accept as a part of this life a fear of death, which we accept as destiny, even though the destiny is inevitable. This fear of death may be programmed into us, but the acceptance of it, the fear, is incongruous, especially the acceptance of the fear as being normal and any plotting to outwit death as being psychotic. Getting back to the capability of the human mind, it seems that we are often out of touch with each other as to the states of mind to a point where murder results from the inadequate sensing of the motives or state of mind of the other person. Nevertheless, people all over the world have no arguments with one another when it comes to general codes of living among their species and between other species. In other words, wolves do not hold worldwide elections and decide that they are going to mate in a marriage type of relationship and that they will not eat their own species. The umpire, besides depending upon the census for its data, must also be aware of the evidence that it is individually programmed. It is mundane in aspect, therefore, and is not aware that it is programmed, nor that it is being moved by the master plan. The master plan is contained in the mind dimension from which we and the physical universe emanate. The mind dimension is like a universal agreement of pre-incarnate man. It is the universal mind of Mary Baker Eddy and the oversoul of Paul Broughton. I prefer to call it the manifesting or manifested mind. The manifested mind emanates from the unmanifested mind. The unmanifested mind might be likened to the Logos and the Absolute to the Parabrahm, from which the Logos and the unmanifested mind emanate. I do not imply that these comparisons are exactly synonymous. I am merely borrowing terms from theosophy because no other comparisons are available. It is like the cradle of creation, this cradle being a transformer of an awareness even more powerful but undifferentiated and more of a universal type of awareness. This latter parent vehicle of awareness I call unmanifested mind, and by unmanifested I mean not witnessable except in the understanding of the phenomena which emanate from it. The major emanating phenomena which we may experience is the manifested mind. It is not entirely unwitnessable. Mystics claim to know of it by entering it. To get back to the manifested mind, we find that it is the prop room of creation, a creation which in relation to the unmanifested mind from which it emanates is less than real and is described as being illusory. The manifested mind is that place where the idea or conception of the non-manifesting mind is made flesh, so that all creatures with their complex biological structures and their even more complex mental structures are projections of the manifested mind. Within the microcosm of the individual mind, we copy our divine parent and likewise make projections even more illusory and nightmarish than our inherited nature or projected existence. The manifesting mind is the manifested mind in action. In other words, the source of a man's life can be traced back fairly easy to this dimension. It is witnessable. People on drugs or in deep spiritual states have witnessed it. Thus, the name manifested mind. It is a living place, a concourse of all souls, because all of us can witness it. Yet, when we witness the projections executed by it, the creation, we must call it the manifesting mind. They are one and the same. But the two words describe or indicate the incoming life or light from the unmanifested mind, which is projected along with the system upon the collective and individual consciousnesses of living people. The empire is like the Janus deity guarded the doors of old Rome. It looks both ways toward the physical world and toward the manifested mind. However, it sees both inadequately. Without some cognizance of the master plan of the manifested mind, it might make decisions for the benefit of the individual only, totally ignoring the production and protection of the young. On the other hand, it sees the master plan inadequately because the umpire, the rational mind, sees little reason for living and keeps on living. If it could be fully see the blueprint for creation, its identification with all the mundane things might lessen and the individual would be inclined to stop its actions or to become extremely indifferent to its experiences. Some of this may be brought out in an explanation of the different types of visualization that man has and how they relate to his mental faculties. Man has three principal mental faculties. He receives, sees, hears, smells, feels, and tastes, records, and reacts. We can call the first a percept, the second, memory, and the third would be reaction, reason, or visualization, which is the mental projection of that which we believe we see when a percept is received. Visualization is the projection literally beamed out of us into our worldview and only then witnessed vainly as reality. This thing seen when so projected may not truly represent the original percept. Man seems to have little control over these faculties. Even his reasoning is colored by his desires, and his desires seem more related to the overall human blueprint than to the individual welfare or understanding. The purpose of sex to the individual seems to be pleasure, but the empire gives us another reading. We are smitten with love, and while smitten, we feel that we have transcended even the animal passions which aroused our curiosity. The empire makes decisions for love and for possession or mutual fidelity as though it had itself transcended this dimension and is making the decision based upon some tremendous insight into the unmanifested mind. The empire's decision in this manner is often regretted and reversed, and the empire momentarily is dismayed that it could have erred so drastically, especially if someone gets killed over the love affair. However, the empire is programmed to keep on, individual after individual, and generation after generation, making the same mistake and accepting the ability to err as part of its destiny. Getting back to the three main functions of man, I would like to break down the three faculties of perception, memory, and reaction. Perception is of two types, the percept or the sensory type, and mental perception. Memory is the material record of the senses, and another input type of memory is that which represents the phenomena listed as DNA, archetypal, or prenatal. Reaction involves the physical response to stimuli and the attitudinal response to the environment, but it also represents the function, which I call projection, which is essentially visualization. Projection is the result of a translation which occurs upon the receipt of a simple percept, which was a sensory percept. So that we have sensory perception, mental perception, sensory memory, and ultra-sensory memory, reflexive reaction, and projection. We must deal first with perception. Most people think that we just pick up things with our senses, that the eye sees and the ear hears, and that those organs relay the seeing and hearing to the brain, and then somewhere inside the brain thinks about it. Then a few people who have noticed the deceptive nature of the senses come to the conclusion that the eye does not see but just relays impulses to the brain, and this is followed by an adjustment inside the brain. However, this latter category of observers fail to tell us what really goes on inside the brain, and more importantly, why the organism feels compelled to adjust or translate world pictures in common agreement with other humans to that which must be a prearranged and acceptable mental image. In other words, our mental image is subject to delusion. We picture, have a mental image of, a person who later confirms that we projected upon that person more or less than they really were. Or we view a hologram and are unaware of the real object under scrutiny. Very few people are aware that much of our seeing is visualization. The same is true of the other senses. Visualization is largely limited to sensory perception. There are other methods of seeing or perceiving. I would like to list 6 different forms of perceiving. Number 1, normal sensory perception. This is ordinary seeing or perceiving. As the result of a sensory stimulus, the mind coordinates the stimulus with previous stimuli and projects back upon the physical environment that which it wants to see. Only this projection is seen by the individual's awareness. To say the same thing more precisely, man visualizes everything that he perceives, thinks he perceives, through the physical senses. It is a normal percept followed by a normal projection. Number 2, abnormal sensory perception. This is illusory or non-validated phenomena. These are visions which apparently are seen by the eyes or percepts connected with the other senses, which later will be found to be invalid or illusory in nature. Included in this category are ghosts that cannot be checked out, hallucinations, holograms, mirages, and hypnotic phenomena that involve the imposition of illusions on the mind of the subject. The next 4 categories have to do with mental perception. A while back, I discussed the ability of the mind to see or perceive. The examples given showed clearly that such perceiving resulted from initial sensory stimuli. There are, however, instances where the mind sees independently of the senses. I call this ability visualization projection not warranted by percepts. Mental visions. Number three, mental visions. Here the mind watches synthetic projections from its memory bank. We conjure up an apple with diamonds embedded in the sides. This is memory revisited and rearranged. This is commonly called imagination. Number four, visions without projection by the perceiver. Non-physical visions, valid according to some means of corroboration or laws of reference. Their general corroboration lies in the fact that they are often found later to have been revelations of some sort. They are ghosts that substantiate their presence by warnings or prophecies. They are dreams, articulate voices from non-visible sources, and instances of deja vu, which are found to be more than a hallucination. It may be that some of these visions are contacts with the manifested mind or with emanations from the manifested mind. Also in this category are direct mind communications, which we pick up accurately from another person, such as in mind reading. In the past, many phenomena which we now describe under the heading ESP or Psi phenomena were previously described for the recipient as being an ability called the sixth sense. This sense can be discovered and developed. It amounts to a sort of intuitive feeler which the mind extends to the mind of another, using in the beginning all manner of clues from the countenance of the other person and even items of posture and tone of voice to guess at first that which the other person may be thinking. But after a while, success will breed accuracy, and later still we will be able to possess a feeling of knowing instead of uncertainty. This feeling of knowing results from persistent checking over a long period of time with the person that we are reading. Group sessions for the purpose of attempting to have rapport and picking up information are good. Number five, visions of mental processes without sensory percepts. This is not the same as the third category, which is reverie or imagination. This is that which we shall later call the process observer. This is the mind which is anterior to the umpire and its phenomena. It is a part of us that sees. It sees the mind, the somatic or umpire mind. It is, in turn, unable to watch itself or any processes peculiar to itself. This is a genuine mental awareness by the real self or ultimate self. Number six, deliberate mental projections. This last category of visions is that which is caused by someone's mind, projection by them, which has an impact on other minds to a point where the recipient may have the conviction that he physically sees the projections. There are visions projected upon the world scene or upon our consciousness by another. Under this heading, we have tulpas, Tibetan materialized humanoids, and the Indian rope trick. Other instances are cases of bilocation, healing at a distance, psychokinesis, transubstantiation, turning water into wine, and so on, and possession. I would like to devote an entire book to this subject and to the methods of attaining expertise in this type of projection. These are manipulations which are unreal even to the laws of the relative plane, or are illusions which are projected into our mind and which we then visualize or project upon the world view. There is a dynamism here in this category which makes man into a momentary creator with limits he never dreamed were possible. There is a mark of the sensational and the miraculous here, truly, for the man with his relative and deluded mind to be able to train himself to create within the microcosm a change of variation which may be contrary to the strict beliefs of mankind about the scientific limitations of the physical world, and contrary to the knowledge that those massive beliefs actually may be the formative substance of this physical world which one individual may be able to affect. Also included in this category is a phenomenon known in esoteric philosophy as transmission, the direct conveyance of a deep spiritual realization. The foregoing vision phenomena demonstrate that in all cases the average person witnesses something he is only partially aware of his apprehension apparatus. Only the first two involve the senses. The first category seems to be an accepted phenomenon, so it is labeled normal sensory perception. In the second category, we are still influenced by the senses. However, there is some defect in our visualization that results from the percepts. The second category above indicates that our senses are not infallible. The third category, mental vision, shows that we can produce visualizations from the mental bank, from the memory bank, with possibly an initial stimulus for the whole daydream from somewhere in the present environment. It shows that we do not need the senses to conceptualize or create visions. They are projections, visualizations limited to our private audience. The next category, the fourth, does not involve projections, visions without projections. These instances demonstrate that the mind is capable of direct mental reception without the senses from intelligences of other people or from unidentified intelligences which are accepted as being other than something which we might project. This faculty would be the passive or receiving side of the projections and the projection ability listed in the sixth category below. These last four categories relate to behavior motivation, yet unfortunately they seem to be deliberately overlooked by the behaviorists, so that only a few really listen to the wealth of testimony that comes from patients whose sensory perceptive mechanisms have been inhibited and whose minds may be supplying genuine data. We choose to ignore thousands of cases where people report dreams that have evidence in them that the information received did not come from the dreamer. Perhaps a person dreams of someone deceased who tells the dreamer where the will or family heirloom is concealed. Psychics such as Peter Hurkos are continually in the news, but there is no comment or explanation of their talent by the mind experts. The determinations of J.B. Ryan in his psychokinetic experiments are ignored, yet psychokinetics, like telepathy, indicate that the mind is extrudable and able to affect the environment and minds of others. If the mind dimension is of greater reality than the somatic and material dimension, we are inviting failure when we insist that mental phenomena all be defined with qualitative chemical analysis and with electrical measurements. Psychologists, for instance, like to play with the electroencephalograph and to pronounce life as being electrical energy and death as being three flat readings on the meter. Voltage may be one of the symptoms of life, but so far it has failed to measure consciousness. If there is a greater reality than the mind dimension, then those who are in search of it cannot ignore the need to thoroughly understand the mind from the somatic mind to the most intricate functionings of the higher mind in its direct mind experiences. We cannot play the desire games of life and expect that procedure to lead us to the truth. Humanity is not God. Nor is democratic agreement among psychologists the final truth.